This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
It really goes without saying the impact that Dr. J. Craig Venter has made in the field of life sciences. He's world-renowned for his remarkable contributions to genomics and life science research. So please help me welcome Dr. Venter for this year's Krieger Lecture Series to talk about human longevity and preventative medicine. Thank you.
I'm going to take you through a journey that sort of combines all the different approaches we've taken and why they have come together and why they're affecting our understanding of human life. So some of the earliest questions we had were trying to go from your genes, your genotype, to predict your phenotype, and your phenotype is the structure. And so if we have the genetic code, can it predict present and future phenotypes? And a way early on that we thought of to try and answer that question was, can we rewrite that code? So early on in the early 1990s, when we sequenced the first genome, we're doing what I call digitizing biology. We're converting the code of DNA, the four chemical letters, A, C, G, and T, into the ones and zeros in the computer. And this database's numbers of ones and zeros has accumulated now at a very fast rate ever since this method that we developed and showed with sequencing the very first genome in 1995. But everybody sort of assumes that this genetic code that we're sequencing represents all of biology. Some people have different points of view, but we wanted to answer, because it's critical if we're going to try and understand our own genomes, does DNA contain all the necessary information for cellular life? There's probably a lot of different ways to answer this, but in 1995, we actually sequenced two genomes, and they're very different from each other. And my colleagues, Ham Smith and Clyde Hutchinson and I, were sitting around trying to work out what would be the ultimate experiment, because the second genome we sequenced was the smallest known living entity. But we wanted to know what was really the basic information for life. And we decided the only way to do this was to synthesize a genome from scratch, trying to put in just the necessary information. So we wanted to reverse this equation. We wanted to start with the ones and zeros in the computer and see if we could recapitulate life. Needless to say, these weren't ideas that were widespread in the scientific community, and grant applications weren't well received, saying we were going to synthesize life. We started using the endowment at the Venter Institute as a beginning, and we decided to start small. We just decided to start with a small virus. PHYX-174 was the first DNA virus that was sequenced. I finished my PhD here in 1975. That virus was first sequenced in 1977. So there hadn't been any type of genome that had been sequenced by the time I finished graduate school here. In fact, only the first human gene had just been sequenced. So for historic reasons, and because this genome can't take a lot of mutations, we decided it would be a great test to see if we could design and build the genome and then boot it up. So we developed a process over a while, mostly to correct the errors. So the machines that write the genetic code, oligonucleotide synthesizers, make frequent errors. It's actually an n minus 1, so the longer the sequence, the more errors there are. So we had to make a method for correcting the errors. So we designed it from the genome that had been published, synthesized it, put it together, corrected the errors. And then we injected this piece of synthetic DNA into E. coli. And the fascinating thing that happened was E. coli just recognized it as a normal piece of DNA, started reading the genetic code, making proteins. The protein self-assembled and made the PHYX virus. And after a certain amount of viral particles accumulated, the cells burst open, and the virus could then infect other cells. And that's what you see here, these clear spots. This is a lawn of E. coli where the virus has killed the E. coli cells. So we said that this is a unique situation. We put in a piece of chemical software, and we ended up with a piece of hardware, the PHYX-174 virus. And it's an important concept. Now, our goal was not to make a small virus. We wanted to make, comparatively, a large bacterial genome that was totally self-replicating. Turns out none of the tools existed for this, and I won't go through all this, but it took us several years to develop the tools to go from writing something 5,000 letters long to writing something over 1 million letters long and doing that accurately. Accuracy is really important when you're writing the code. When you're reading the code, you can tolerate a certain amount of errors because you can estimate what that should have been. When you're writing the code, it's the same as the genome in your cell, in your cells. If it has errors, you're going to have dysfunctional biology. So we had to do the synthesis extremely accurately. The design had to be perfect, et cetera. So this took a very long time. But just to show you what was involved, these little blue lines here represent 1 KB pieces. So we synthesized pieces that were 1,000 letters long. We took 10 of those and put them together to make pieces that were 10,000 letters long. Then we took 10 of those and made pieces that were 100,000 letters long. And at this scale, these are big pieces of DNA. They're hard to manipulate. And we found by putting the 11 100,000 letter pieces into yeast with the right overlapping design that yeast just assembled this into the complete genome. So we had two teams. We had the teams working on the chemistry and the synthesis, and then we had the teams working on the biology. Now, it was a little bit complicated. Those of you probably have already noticed this, that we now had a prokaryotic genome inside of a eukaryotic cell, and we had to learn how to extract that genome from the eukaryotic cell to be able to transplant it. And the transplantation team took several years to solve the problem because you can't pipette genomes. They're too fragile. So we have to move them around in gel blocks. And the team developed a method of genome transplantation. Now, most of you are probably familiar with the experiments going back even before the 1950s with frog cells where you just cut out the nucleus and you could do nuclear transplantation. In fact, that's what happens today with cloning. It's really easy to do. But bacterial cells, by definition, don't have a nucleus. The DNA is just inside the cell, so there's no way just to pop it out. So let me show you what we think happened. So we had a recipient cell, and that recipient cell is a different species with its own genetic software. Using these unique methods of moving around in gels and then injecting it into the cell, all of a sudden now we have a species, the body of one species, with two sets of genetic software. Now, some of you might know Ham Smith. He just turned 85. He's been working together with me for over 20 years. He got the Nobel Prize in 1978 for discovering restriction enzymes, the scissors that cut DNA. So we actually built that into our strategy, and the genome that we partially designed and made had restriction enzymes that would recognize the DNA in the cell as foreign material. So when these proteins were expressed, they recognized the original chromosome in the cell as foreign material and chewed it up. And so now we have the body of one species and the genetic software of another. And so what happened in a very short period of time, we ended up with these completely new cells where every single protein, every single molecule in the cell was derived from this chemically made piece of DNA. Obviously, this was a big surprise to the world and was a big announcement in 2010. It's the first time, I think, in modern science where we got quotations from the President of the U.S. and the Pope in the same day. President Obama referred it to his new ethics committee as their number one charge. The Pope said they didn't create life, they just changed one of life's motors. So you didn't know that life had motors, but now you do. Now, there's other things we can do to make sure that nobody confuses this with a normal life. We created a code that we can embed in the genome where we can write the entire English language using the genetic code with numbers and punctuation. And people have used the ASCII code before, but we think it's actually dangerous. So our code puts in very frequent stop codons so that if we put Rady School of Business in there, that wouldn't create a new toxin that would kill everybody. So it puts in stop codons so that we don't get new unusual peptides. But in this code was all the instructions for decoding it. There was a built-in URL, so it said once you've decoded this, please send the genome an email message saying you've decoded it. And also contained in there were the names of the 46 scientists that have contributed to the work over time, names of the institutions, and I added three quotations from the literature. I don't know if you can read those clearly, but the first was from James Joyce, to live, to err, to fall, to triumph, to recreate life out of life. We kind of thought we were doing that. The second is from American Prometheus, Oppenheimer's biography, what he heard from a teacher early on in his career, see things not as they are, but as they might be. And the third from Richard Feynman, what I cannot build, I cannot understand. So we're pretty excited about this, and this got a lot of press attention. And then we got a legal letter from James Joyce, a state attorney, asking if we had copyright permission to use that quotation. But under U.S. law, you can use up to a paragraph as long as you do it with attribution. So we ignored that. Then we started getting letters from a Caltech scientist saying we had misquoted Feynman. But if you go on the internet, this is the main quotation that you found, and that's we argued with him. And so finally, he dug into the Caltech archives with a photo of Feynman's blackboard with his original quotation, "What I cannot create, I do not understand." I think it's actually a much better and more meaningful quotation for what we're doing. And we don't know if his biographer changed it or what happened, but we've gone back to edit the genome to get the correct quotation. So Feynman will be on our side in the future. He is dead. Okay, just in case you guys didn't know. So we wanted to go on to the next stage of designing a genome completely from scratch in the computer. And we thought this was going to be really easy because from 1995 on, labs around the world took the genomes, subtracted them from each other, and got down to what they considered an essential gene set. And you can find 100 different papers in the literature all sort of coming up with the same answer. So they decided that it was all right. And we even started to believe it. And so we set up a contest in the lab to see who could come up with the best design for life from scratch. And everybody spent their time picking the genes that should be required and should do something. We synthesized all these, booted them up, and not one single one worked. So we knew that something was wrong. And so we went to a design build system of adding back sets of genes, growing them up, testing them for life. If we got life, then we went back through cycles of trying to eliminate some of those genes to find out which ones weren't necessary. And we finally ended up with a minimal genome. But the biggest surprise was one-third of the genes were new, unknown genes that had never been described before. All we know is if you remove one of those genes from the cell, you can't get life. So the scientific community was off by at least a third. This is just this cell type. Every cell type will have a different minimal genome. So this is a minimal genome, not the minimal genome. And so we spent a lot of time now trying to characterize those 149 genes. Some of them are transporters, but we don't know what they transport. But also, if you'll see, when we look at evolution, they're highly conserved across evolution, including to the human genome. So this is what the cells look like. We call it SYN 3.0 because the 2.0 was a larger version based on some of our designs. But it contains all the things that we thought should be in there, plus these 149 genes that the cell can't live without. So had we not tried to approach science the way Feynman described, we never would have learned that there were a third of genes essential for life that were missing. As I said, when you look across evolution, these unknown genes are highly conserved. We can take things even further. We can try and do much better than many billion years of evolution. And we use computer terms. Here we use the term defragmentation. So it's like a disk that is too cluttered. And if we're going to design life in the future, it'd be nice to have nice, clear sets of cassettes that we knew what they are, that you just plug in those cassettes and then you could do more elaborate design from there. And the biggest surprise was we could totally rearrange the genome by function, and these cells lived and worked just as well as they did before. So the order that you get from this scrambled evolution just represents scrambled evolution. And you can see just the number of changes we had to make in just 1/8 of the genome to reorder things by function. But we were pleasantly surprised that this does work. So we think that these approaches help prove that we were able to write the software of life, and that it proved that DNA contained everything necessary and sufficient for life. These cells have all kinds of complex regulation, but all that is coded for in the primary genetic code. So we wanted to go up a little bit in scale, and It's important thinking about these single cells with a few hundred genes, where a third of the genes we don't yet understand. And yet we want to understand our own genomes. You read in the paper every day because a tool called CRISPRs were invented. Everybody wants to start editing genomes and making new versions of humans. But we'll examine that a little bit. So actually in 2000, we had the first sequenced human genome. Then my institute here in La Jolla in 2007 published the first complete diploid genome. So the difference is all of us have two parents, and we get a complete genome from each one of them. And you'll start to understand why things come out so uniquely when we sequence a number of sperm cells from a single individual. No two sperm cells are alike. When we sequence egg cells, no two egg cells are alike because they're both haploid. They just have half the genome. But it's a scrambled set from what was there before. So having this first complete diploid genome and having things separated into the maternal and paternal haplotypes was the first time we saw that. So then there's a big gap from early 2000 to just recently when we started human longevity. And the reason for this gap was that genome that we sequenced in 2000 cost $100 million. The computer that we used to assemble it cost $50 million. So these weren't highly replicable events. We didn't have anybody coming up saying, can you sequence my genome for $100 million? We would have taken on the contract if we had it. And so for science to proceed, we had to wait till technology changed substantially. And there's lots of reasons for that. But basically, the tools of genetics were exhausted about 20 or 30 years ago. And we all have basically the same genome. We differ about 3% out of roughly 6.2 billion letters of genetic code. But to understand that 3% difference, we need a very large number of genomes, not just families with diseases that have been followed for a while. In the process of doing all this, we set up to try and change the practice of medicine, trying to predict things from the genetic code. So we wanted to go from reactive to predictive and proactive. I'll give you lots of examples of this, of you're considered healthy. It's kind of a medieval definition. If you have no symptoms and you look okay, right? Your doctor won't want to see you. They'll send you away. People actually get upset with us because we're screening healthy people. But in fact, we can tell you whether you're healthy. Not too many other people can actually tell you that. And you can't tell whether you're healthy yourself just by how you feel. So medicine today is reactive. You get a tumor, it grows big enough. It causes disruption of some function. It causes pain. You get bone pain from metastases. Something that causes you to go see your physician. And then it starts the reactive part of trying to work out what that is. So we're trying to change this and turn this into being predictive from the genome, proactive, preventative, and obviously very personalized. Now, to put these numbers in context, if you're a male in the U.S. and you're between 50 and 74 years of age, almost 40% of you will never see the age of 74. For females, 24% of you will never see the age of 74. If you have any doubts about that, look at your high school or college yearbooks, right? A few people start to be missing along the way. And the interesting thing is for both males and females, two-thirds of the risk is cardiovascular and cancer. The ratios are slightly different in males and females, but it's roughly two-thirds of the risk. And all other causes are the last third. So our thinking was if we could just do something with predicting cancer and cardiovascular disease early on, where something could be done about it, it would have a huge impact on medicine. But we're looking across the genome, we're looking across the species, so we're trying to cover the entire repertoire. So here's some death curves and how they've changed over the last century or so. And you can see the average age has gone from the 50s to 84. But you can also see when you get down to 90 plus, it's a very small percentage of the population. It's not like half of us are living to 90. But we think we can shift this curve with knowledge and prediction. We don't know what the upper limit of this is, but our goal is to improve the healthy lifespan, not just numbers of years. So we set up, we bought lots of Illumina sequencers, and we set up the largest sequencing facility in the world, and we started sequencing large numbers of human genomes. We have over 40,000 to date. It's about 20 petabytes of data. And just for reference, one of these machines costs roughly $1 million. Each one of these machines is 1,350 equivalents of Celera Genomics in 2000. That's a pretty dramatic change in that time. And the cost has gone from $100 million down below $2,000. And fortunately, computing has changed as well. So that $50 million computer, you can buy a card for your PC with a teraflop of compute capacity. So we're using distributed computing with Amazon Cloud and generating this data. In 2012, you could have indexed the entire internet with 12 petabytes of data. So this is big data. If we actually generate 10 million genomes, just the ACs, Gs, and Ts will be an exabyte of data. Our computer systems are not quite ready for it. There's a quote from me, a partial quote from me that's used in some Amazon Cloud ads. I said that we were in the 1% group of Amazon, so we're up there with video streamers and porn sites, but that we need a large number of computes, and they couldn't provide them, and we blew a giant hole in the Amazon cloud. So you can imagine which part of the quote they left off. So just to recalculate on 10,000 genomes, we'd need a large number of cycles that wasn't ready on demand. So to get up to exabyte level of computing is going to be a challenge. So let me show you the kind of things we're finding. We published a paper a while ago on the first 10,000 genomes, actually trying to set accuracy levels for a clinical level of sequencing. And here's what the coverage kind of looks like. So even today, the complete genome is not being completely covered. The blue spikes are where there's high coverage, high accuracy coverage. And the gray areas are centromeres, telomeres, where the coverage is much lower. But you can see we have a very small false positive and false negative rate in the key areas that cover all known gene areas. One of the surprises was At around 8,000 genomes, we saturated all the common variants in the human population. So everything that we share in common, we can just pick 8,000 people, and that's enough to cover it. Those of you who do things like 23andMe, that's mostly what they measure, is the common variants in the population. If we were going to sequence any of your genomes, we'd find on average about 8,000 rare variants, and by rare, things that would occur in our database only once. And I'd like to show you some increasing data on why it's these rare variants that are really essential to understand for each one of us. They're what cause our unique traits, including diseases. Our informatics team just looked at all the data, over a billion data points, and just asked the question, are there some points in the genome that cannot tolerate any mutations and be compatible with life? So every time you see one of these down arrows, that's a place where if there's a mutation, it would result in a lack of viable life, a spontaneous abortion, et cetera. So there are reasons just from a series of mutations that we can now plot that we know are not compatible with life. Some other areas are really interesting to predict. We put together all the transmembrane domains in the genome, and it's very interesting. You can see the bars here. So this is the transmembrane domain, the lipid domain, and you can see why a mutation here would be potentially catastrophic with loss of function. If you get a mutation that changes it to a charged amino acid, this protein would pop out of the membrane and would be clearly a loss of function of a key receptor or a key transporter. This is a field that's fraught with bad data and information. And mice are not good models for humans, at least not most humans. And cell lines are not good models for what happens in humans. So if we look at essential gene knockouts in mice, only a small portion of those overlap with what look like essential genes in the living human population. And the same thing with studies that are done in cell lines. They make lots of predictions, but only a few of these predictions actually overlap with reality when we look at the human genome. I said it's the rare variants that are really important. This is a little bit of a complex graph. So this purple line is increased pathogenicity. And as we go from genes that are low essential to key essential genes for life, the number of variants in those genes goes way down. It's not surprising when you think about it. It's a gene that's essential for life. It can't tolerate a lot of mutations. So just by mapping these kinds of things, we get information just looking at the genome without knowing almost anything else. So it's getting very exciting as the data sets expand. And let me show you a couple of applications with it. We don't need huge families with diseases. We need a single patient now. And this was a patient from Rady's Children's with a very rare disease called Dullahan syndrome that there's only about 30 cases of in the world. And this child's skin is covered with tumors. And those of you who know how to read the MRI, this is not a normal-looking brain. In fact, it's more amazing that this child is alive and has relatively normal functions. Nobody had ever characterized the genetics with this disease. So we did what's called a trio. We sequenced both parents' genomes and the child's genomes. And it became immediately apparent why this was a multigenic disorder and why it was extremely rare. These orange bars that you see are where the parents have the exact same genome sequence. So it says the parents were very closely related to each other. In fact, they were second cousins, not first cousins, but they're from a small village in Mexico that had a lot of inbreeding over the years to where their genomes started to look very much alike. So if both parents had rare alleles that would never express unless both parents had copies of them, by definition in all these areas, these are going to be disease-causing alleles. And so we just looked through for genes associated with neurodevelopment, and they were all rare alleles that were in these homogeneous regions. One gene that really stood out that was very interesting was the neurofibromatosis 1 gene. This is a gene that I actually sequenced a long time ago at NIH. This is elephant man's a gene that causes lots of tumors. So we thought it's interesting. Associated with the brain would be these mutations, and this one might explain all the tumors. And we decided to look more closely at it, and it was very interesting because neither parent had this mutation. And I show it because it tells you a little bit more about each of us, that we get the gene sets that we get from a chromosome set from each parent, but we also have several hundred to several thousand spontaneous mutations. This was a very unlucky one in this child. It was at a point in the NF1 gene that led it to causing these tumors. But this is a single case, and that's what we can do now by the richness of the data and the interpretation. Is we can solve these just with a single patient. We're using these approaches to try and understand cancer better. We have a comprehensive cancer program at HLI where we, in the individuals with cancer, we sequence their genome and we sequence the genome from the tumor to a high level. We sequence RNA from the tumor. We isolate T cells. We sequence the entire T-cell population. Occasionally, we do liquid biopsies and other things. And I'll show you one example of a man in his 50s who had an HPV-16-caused head and neck cancer. And so we sequenced his genome. In fact, it became obvious just from looking at his genome why he had cancer. He had multiple oncogenes that were mutated. He had some immune genes that were mutated that made it look like he would have had a compromised immune system. In fact, he was immune suppressed. That with oncogenes is very bad on its own. And then from his microbiome, we found HPV-16 present. So it was more of a case of when, not if, he would get cancer. If this was your profile, nobody's tried the HPV-16 vaccine in adults, but it should be tried because there's a large population now that's getting head and neck cancer from acquiring this virus through sexual activity. And also, if you are hesitating about putting your kids on the HPV vaccine, please don't. It will potentially save their lives. But here's what we found. 25,000 mutations in the tumor. 315 of these were in protein coding regions. So these are the so-called neoantigens. So if you have a good immune system, your immune system will recognize these neoantigens as different from human proteins, create an immune response, and will clear those cells from your system. We're constantly clearing tumor cells from our system. If this fog goes away and you go outside in the sun, in an hour, you can get 10,000 mutations in your skin cells. But we're constantly shedding our skin cells. You replace it every 2 weeks. That dust in your house, that's you. And that's why you can never get rid of it. There's always more. And other tissues that turn over, they get rid of these mutations. But we're constantly clearing our system. But if you have a weakened immune system, that limits that. So we're trying to do a lot with this. We work out from the mutated genes which drugs should work, which ones shouldn't work. We look in pathways. We characterize the T cells. And we're taking this further by taking the neoantigens and trying to make a new, unique set of highly personalized vaccines derived totally from information from the patient's tumor. And we're starting clinical trials this year in collaboration with the Moores Cancer Center. So collecting genomes was half the equation. We knew we'd need a large set of genomes, but just having a huge database of genomes is kind of like one hand clapping. If we're going to work out what the code is, we need to have the other half. We have to have all the phenotype data and descriptions of those people. So a lot of our studies, we were getting them from collaborations here at UCSD and others where people had done deep characterization of certain patient populations. We're sequencing whole clinical trials for pharmaceutical companies, and they give us phenotype data, but it was really inadequate. So we set up the health nucleus as primarily a very extensive phenotyping center. And I'll go through some of these things. We sequence the whole genome. We sequence the microbiome, the metabolome, and we do a lot of imaging, brain imaging, whole body for cancer, CT scanning for heart vasculature. We do 4D echo, a number of things. The trouble is our simple science of just thinking we're going to collect a lot of good phenotype data, and we only let healthy people into the nucleus. All of a sudden, we started diagnosing a lot of complex disease. And it was a surprise to a lot of us. Some of the tools are really fantastic, and they were developed at UCSD, such as this restriction spectrum imaging, that instead of using contrast media for MRI, this just measures the mobility of water molecules in tissues. In cancer, the nuclei are a little bit bigger, the water molecules are restricted, and it shows up as bright lights versus other tissues. And here's a study from UCSD diagnosing prostate cancer straight from the MRI image without any contrast. And you can see these bright areas are where the tumor is, and you can see from the pathology it totally corresponded to where what these images showed. And here's one that shows it a little bit more clearly. So this is what the MRI picture looks like. The bright area really indicates cancer, and that's where the cancer turned out. We've now roughly, I think it's 5% of men over 50, we're diagnosing high-grade prostate cancer. This technique won't pick up low-grade prostate cancer. So there's two types. There's the type you die with and the type you die from. This picks up the type you die from, so it's really important. Several well-known people in the community here had this diagnosed just from the MRI at the health nucleus and have had their prostates removed and feel that their lives were saved by this one technique and diagnosis. I'm one who practices what he preaches with diagnoses. I'm always the guinea pig for the test there. They did the MRI on me, and I had high-grade prostate cancer, unbeknownst to myself. 6 weeks ago, I had my prostate removed, and just this simple imaging technique saved my life because I've had lots of prostate biopsies that all said they were negative and I didn't have cancer. The biopsies missed the area where the tumor was. And that's quite frequently what happens in prostate cancer. It's very nice technology now because You can take the MRI image and overlay it on the ultrasound image. And so the urologist knows exactly where to take the biopsy. And in mine, as I said, they had 20 shots on goal, and they missed it every time. But mine came back very high-grade prostate cancer. Finding it early, they think they got it all out in time, and I'm cancer-free. Thank you. So it really fits the story that we try to convince everybody that knowledge is power. If you have this knowledge, you may think you're healthy. I thought I was pretty damn healthy. Turns out I had high-grade prostate cancer, and the statistics aren't great. If it metastasizes, the five-year survival is 28%. So if you can get it before it metastasizes, which we've done every time because we've caught it early, it's been very successful. We find all kinds of unusual things. We find large ovarian cysts that women aren't aware that they have. And these aren't necessarily cancerous, but they're so large. The way these present in the emergency room is with the woman having massive internal bleeding just because these things twist and rip blood vessels. One of the most exciting things that we can get right out of the MRI, again with no imaging, is your metabolic status. And this is probably going to be one of the most important things going forward, because we can tell how much organ fat you have simply from these MRI images. So normal is 4% or less. We have some individuals as high as 38%. They're going to be needing liver transplants soon. They weren't the least bit aware that they were sick. We can also easily diagnose Alzheimer's disease. NeuroQuant is this scientist in UCSD radiology led by Anders Dale, measures quantitatively from the MRI images 20 regions of the brain and gives you very accurate data. For example, this yellow area here is the hippocampus. So it measures that area very quantitatively. Here's somebody with frank Alzheimer's disease. You can see the hippocampus is one of the first areas where you see changes, and you see these big voids around there. So it's not hard at all once you know even what to look for to see these. But when the changes are more subtle, they show up in as little as 3 months on repeated MRI imaging. This kind of data coupled with the genome data allows us to predict things up to 20 years in advance before your first symptoms. People have all kinds of unusual tumors in their brains. We find all kinds of meningiomas or cavernomas. These are vascular tumors, and their biggest risk, if they bleed, they cause massive strokes. With cardiovascular testing, we have a number of unique approaches. We do 4D echo, we do remote testing, and we do CT scans. So if you haven't had 4D echo, it's really phenomenal because we get these great pictures of the heart. You can see all four chambers. You can zoom down and look exactly down a valve and see its status. But more importantly, we measure the Doppler shift, so you get blue-red shifts. And so this is at least 100 times more sensitive than the best physician with a stethoscope for determining murmurs. It just shows up as the Doppler shift in the data. One individual just had this done at the Health Nucleus. He took his scans up to a cardiology group at Stanford. And they were really freaked out that he had this data and wanted to know how he managed to get it. So, but those images alone can give us a lot. We can measure, we see a lot of people with distended aortas. But CT scans are really fantastic. This is actually my heart. I usually use these for HR meetings to prove I have one. But with the CT score, you get a very accurate measurement of the amount of calcium in your coronary arteries. And if you do this with contrast, we don't. If somebody wants contrast, we send them over to UCSD to get the exact volume of the coronary arteries. But the remote monitoring is one of the most valuable things we do. We just give you a little patch to wear for 2 weeks. And from this, we've discovered a number of people that have potentially fatal arrhythmias. Here's three that all had episodic atrial fibrillation for up to 8 hours a day. So as you, most of you probably know, that's one of the major causes of stroke. Just in the fibrillating aorta, you accumulate clots, and then they get moved to the lungs or the brain. And so these were treated just by putting them on anticoagulants. We found two people with episodic heart block. I assume most of you would know if your heart rate went down to 20 beats a minute or less. But these two individuals had no idea. They were sudden cardiac death waiting to happen, and they're both now on pacemakers. So remote monitoring is really improving. And here's just sort of a change in lifetime risk that we've been able to measure for people, and that if they follow the changes, it can have a huge impact. Again, from the MRI, but also from DEXA scan, there's a new program where we can very accurately quantitate your organ fat versus your peripheral fat, measures your exact muscle mass. If you want to know how much your left leg weighs and your right leg, we can tell you those differences. But it's really important for tracking these things. Some athletes want to know these masses. So it's a lot of data now from imaging. We're finding significant findings in about 40% of, quote, healthy people. Up to 20% of those are really significant and likely life-saving. We've now done over 500, and the statistics are still growing. And the biggest challenge is we're trying to link things back to the genome. Many things like polycystic kidney disease, the genetic changes for that are known. That shows up very readily on the MRI. But we're trying to go the other way, where we see accumulation of phenotypic effects, like we have a number of people with distended aortas, including several father and sons that have it. We found a single gene duplication that looks like it correlates with that. And that's our goal as we go along with this data, to get where we can predict much more of it straight from the genome in the future. And we do this trying to apply machine learning. The complexity of petabytes of data with the complexity of all this information, it's a little bit too much for individuals to sit down at the computer and sort through it all and draw a conclusion. So we have to teach computers to train them to think in this space to put things together. When we sequence your genome, we predict a lot of things. We predict your height, your weight, your BMI, your eye color, your hair color, et cetera. But we wanted to go further. We wanted to see if we could use machine learning to predict faces straight from the genetic code. And the reason for that, there's lots of different reasons for this. But if we're making predictions from your genome, the first thing we try to convince you is your genome material really codes for you and nobody else. There's no two genomes alike. We can tell identical twins apart relatively easily. So we got 1,000 volunteers where we did 3D imaging, sequenced their genome, and did a lot of other phenotyping. And we developed a number of different models using those 1,000. If you haven't had 3D imaging done, they're not very attractive. And so to make people not unhappy with us, we smoothed the images a little bit. But this is the prediction This is based on the photograph. This is just based on the ACs, Gs, and Ts. Now, the U.S. government says you can de-identify a genome just by not having your name, address, and social security number or a photo with it. But we can get the photo right out of the genetic code. That, you know, of course it codes for how we look. You know, this isn't just a random lottery. It's built into our coding. So it has political implications. It makes us treat the security of our database much higher than anybody else. And we don't let anybody run algorithms to try and identify somebody in our database. We've had a lot of famous people, a lot of movie stars go through our system. They don't want somebody going through searching for their traits and identification. But we try to combine all this, and we call it the HLI Health Intelligence Engine. But in, machine learning, computing, massive informatics is a very key part of this, and mixing all these pieces together. And just data volume per week, we're ahead of Instagram and Twitter, although with Trump tweeting, that might push him up a little bit more. Not as much as Google Photos, but as our sequencing expands, we just signed a deal with a life insurance company that they're going to encourage 160,000 of their clients to come get their genome sequenced. So think of proactive medicine and curative and preventive medicine. So proactive, the kind of diagnosis I had, became curative. In every one of the cancers we've discovered, we discover major cancer in about 1 out of 40 people. Every one of them has been successfully treated and eliminated. So our goal is to change medicine from a clinical science supported by data to a data science supported by clinicians. Thank you very much for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.